Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini, literary producer for Spokane Public Radio. We're joined in the studio today by author Jacqueline Watterson, whose new short story collection, Ventriloquisms, is the winner of the most recent Spokane Prize for Short Fiction. Welcome, Jacqueline. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Lauren Holey, interim assistant director for Willow Springs Books, which awards the annual Spokane Prize. Lauren, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Ventriloquisms is a short story collection, and it's really unlike any collection of stories I've ever read before. It's surreal and surprising and funny and strange. And so before we talk too much about it, I want to jump right in and hear a story. So Jacqueline, would you be willing to read a story for us?
Sure. Thank you. So I'm going to start by reading a story that's called A Landlord is an Act. My sister had taken up with a landlord who owned our building, most of the others on the block, and a toilet factory. My sister had taken to putting toilets in the most outlandish places and could not be reasoned with. Peg called it a phase, but my sister said, "Flushing is both ancient and contemporary in every sense." My sister had taken up with a landlord whose hands were machines. The landlord was arrogant and sloppy in his uniform, and his hands resembled electric can openers from the 1970s. The landlord was only 30 years old and often groped my sister in public. His hands could not open cans. Peg was ruffled and swallowed a pill without water. "We must," she said, "take action." But the pill made Peg sleepy, and I followed suit. And soon we were evicted for non-payment of rent. What I mean is, my sister is arrogant and sloppy, and when she was with the landlord, these qualities were enhanced. We can call her dress a uniform because it resembled one. Lace, polka dots, zippers. My sister's hands took on a metallic sheen and burned in the sun. Though she has never been employed, my sister is a resourceful woman. The landlord raised rent and bought a small canning factory where peaches were stuffed into tin with uncanny regularity. My sister began placing bowls of once canned peaches on top of all the toilets she had put in outlandish places. But really, what I'm trying to say is that the landlord was neither benevolent nor a movie star. He didn't have the looks and he didn't have the stomach. I've seen a lot of things, and those syrupy peaches and bowls on top of those toilets. My sister said, "You ought to leave Peg behind." Instead, Peg and I stayed on the sidewalk and peddled pills until we had enough to buy a cannery of our own. Peas. My sister could not understand the psychology behind this, and she said, "Peas are such a melancholy vegetable, the color of inaction." My sister, around this time, was always departing with her landlord, who preferred peaches, finally, to groping. The peas changed us, made us competitive with the landlord, whom my sister began insisting we call Art. The landlord kept his buildings locked, but we hired an actor to deliver cans of peas. To what end? Melancholia is not necessarily inactive. My sister said, "You've got to stop." To which I replied, "It matters little to me whether you can console your landlord. For my part, I prefer privacy to tact."
That was author Jacqueline Watterson reading her story, A Landlord is an Act, from the short story collection Ventriloquisms, which is the winner of the Spokane Prize for Short Fiction from Willow Springs Books. And Lauren Holey, interim director of Willow Springs Books, is here. And Lauren, could you tell us a little bit about the press and about the Spokane Prize?
Yeah, so the Spokane Prize for Short Fiction is run by Willow Springs Books, which is the literary press staffed by students of EWU's MFA program. Each year, in addition to publishing the collection of short fiction that we get from the prize, we publish a poetry chapbook in the American Surrealist tradition under the auspices of the Acme Poetry Series. Previous prize winners have included Nathan Oates, Molly Giles, and Glory Simmons, who read at the Gitlit Festival in Spokane last year. Ventriloquisms by Jacqueline Watterson was chosen by contest judge Alexis M. Smith, author of Marrow Island and Glaciers. Previously, the contest has been judged by local authors Sharma Shields, Sean Bestel, and Jess Walter.
Thanks, Lauren. And so I understand you were on part of the team that discovered Jacqueline's manuscript, for lack of a better word,
yeah.
Found it in the submissions. And so can you talk about what stood out about this and the process of it going from this manuscript that you found in submissions to becoming the prize winner?
Yeah. So I wasn't the first reader on the collection, but I was an early reader. And this one actually had mixed results. And so the managing editor at the time was reading over it. And she's like, I don't understand it, but I can't put it down. And so she passed it to me. And I also was like, I can't put it down. There's something really unique happening in this collection. And so we just kept moving it forward through the process. And ultimately, it won, which I think we knew that it would.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to describe at least a first read of this collection is like, I don't really understand this, but I can't put it down. I think that's a great way of describing it. So Jacqueline, could you talk a little bit about where was the genesis of this project and what was the original idea for this collection?
Yeah. So when I'm thinking about writing and trying to write, I'm always more interested in asking questions and thinking about what language can help us to realize that we don't understand. And so I always do want my stories to ask more questions than make statements. And so I'm always interested in finding images that are in some sense inevitable, but also surprising, and using language to kind of express the feeling of living that is mysterious and strange and just full of mystery and, you know, has these moments that stick out in memory for various reasons, even when we don't understand them. So once the title came along, Ventriloquisms, and I had that image in my mind of, you know, a performer up on stage with a doll on their knee, that helped me to really conceptualize the collection and put it together as a book rather than just, you know, several stories that I had written.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about that title, Ventriloquisms. So ventriloquists use a dummy to speak through. And a lot of the characters in this book seem sort of flat or like props or dummies in a way, more so than sort of realist fiction where you're trying to make a character come alive as like a real person. So can you talk about what does that allow you to do differently, speaking through sort of a dummy character rather than a quote, real character?
Well, I think it allows me to, again, pay more attention to the language than, for example, plot elements. So not that the pieces in the collection don't have plot, but a lot of times I'm interested in, you know, sort of an anti-narrative structure and creating pieces that just allow me to, you know, stretch my own ability with language and test myself and ask questions of myself. And I think that having, you know, characters that sort of speak through other characters allows that language to become distilled in some sense and to be the aspect of the writing that's the most prominent. So I'm not so much interested in like the psychological development of characters as I am in what can they say or what can they not be able to say through each other and through maybe the events that are depicted in the story.
Well, Jacqueline Watterson, author of Ventriloquisms, is here with us today. And let's hear another story from the collection, winner of the Spokane Prize for Short Fiction.
Sure. I'm going to read a short piece that's called A Devout Ornamentation. Melissa works regular hours to my irregular ones and often phones me from the desk at her office, especially on Mondays. Yesterday, she said, I'm bringing over the head. The head is something that belonged to her recently deceased grandparent. These mounted heads, often severed from ungulates, were, Melissa promises, very popular for many centuries. The head in question is missing an eye. The head in question weighs 80 pounds. Melissa and her family think that because I'm a writer and working irregularly, I should have the head. It is my personal policy never to argue with Melissa or Melissa's family. This morning, the head was delivered by Melissa's brother, Scott. Scott is wicked. I waited until after he left to prop the head in the armchair. I angled it toward my disused fireplace, unfolded a blanket beside it, and came to my bedroom. The cat, wary of the head, has followed me, and we have closed the door. That was 7 hours ago, and the phone has been ringing. Melissa, I'm sure. "We are the new owners of a head," I said to the cat. She closed one eye, slowly. Life is often munificent, and there's nothing like a severed head in your armchair to remind you. Around noon, my boyfriend came over. I heard him cooking noodles in the kitchen. Before long, he was eating at my yellow formica table, another gift from another of Melissa's dead relatives. He didn't come into the bedroom, and I didn't go out, and after a while, he rinsed his bowl, placed it upside down on the drain board, and left again. He's like that, my boyfriend. It's soothing having him around, which is not something I can say of the head. It is not soothing having the head around. So far, it has been mostly vexing. The head belonged, in the first place, to a caribou. In the second place, I believe Melissa's grandparents shot the caribou. Who can say why? The caribou's conservation status is least concern, meaning no one puzzles how to save the caribou. Experts have deemed there are enough caribou, and no one's concerned for this one, dead, or for all the others, still living. Melissa arrives. She's my third visitor in one day. Very unusual. To say nothing of the head, but of course Melissa does. "It will be company for you," she says. "Now open this window and let me in." Melissa is standing outside my bedroom window. It's 6 p.m., and she's taken the train back from her office. Melissa is an indelicate and expressive woman. She is my friend, and because I live on the first floor, she often comes to my bedroom window. Climbing in, she takes an electric drill with a long cord from her work bag. She plunges it into the empty socket in my bedroom and goes out to the living room. The cat has gone under the bed, and I consider doing the same, but in keeping with my policy, I follow Melissa to the living room, where the drill resounds. I didn't want. I was merely trying to work. What makes explaining this so difficult? I had never met Melissa's grandparent, presumably the second owner of the head, and I felt this keenly, looking at Melissa and the head she was mounting on my wall. I felt concern, because at some point you stop believing you will not get old, and you know your things will go to other people's homes, whether they want them or not. We choose durable things, and they last. Melissa unplugged her drill and retracted its cord, leaving me with the head, its eye hole beckoning.
That's Jacqueline Watterson reading her short story, A Devout Ornamentation, from the collection Ventriloquisms. And so Willow Springs Books publishes the Spokane Prize every year. And also with us in the studio today is Lauren Holy, Interim Assistant Director of Willow Springs Books.
Yeah, you talked about kind of what you like to explore in your stories, and I was wondering if you could give an example of where the story started and how it developed from that initial, for lack of a better term, idea nugget. I was thinking specifically about the Pinch Belly story.
Sure. Pinch Belly has an interesting origin story, I think. So I am married to another writer, Michael Xu Yongsham, and as a gift, he once gave me a thesaurus that was from 1937. And the thesaurus is really an interesting study in the author's mind, because a lot of the synonyms that it gives don't seem like synonyms to me for the words that they say that they're synonyms for. And I came across a word in that thesaurus that was pinch belly, and that book is really sort of, I call it the spell book, because when I'm, you know, feeling stuck or I'm not sure where to go with a particular piece of writing, I can just flip through it, and it's just this amazing list of words. And you know, the age of the book gives it this defamiliarized feeling, and does with language what I'm always trying to do, which is, you know, make it strange again, and you know, ask questions and find mystery. So, you know, in that book, I found the word pinch belly, and I wasn't so much interested in the actual dictionary definition of the word as I was in, you know, what the word elicited for me. And it just seems like a very frightening word to me. So I decided to write something about it. And pinch belly, of course, became this monster who punishes girls. And it really did start with that particular word.
That's awesome. Really cool. I love the idea of like sort of mining for interesting words.
Yeah.
And something you said about something you like to do is try to make language strange again.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit more about that and how you use language. I'm struck in reading this book that, you know, it seems like you're using language almost more like a poet than a prose writer. Obviously, prose writers are interested in language and images, but you seem to be particularly interested in sort of the sound of the prose and what the language is doing on the page.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, everybody uses language so regularly, you know, just in speaking with each other and communicating with each other. And so often what happens in everyday life is that language becomes invisible and we think of it just as a vehicle to get a particular message across. But I'm really interested in thinking about, you know, the language as that message and what is embedded in the language, and how can we, you know, think about the sounds of words and the associations of words, you know, in a new way, and not have language be invisible, but to have it be, you know, the most prominent thing in a book or in a collection of stories. And so when I'm writing, I do think a lot about the sounds of words and the sounds of sentences. I really, really agonize over sentences. So it can, you know, take me weeks sometimes to write a single sentence. And I just, you know, repeat it over and over and over again to myself, reading it out loud and thinking about it silently, and, you know, just try to make the best possible sentences that I can.
Yeah.
So in editing the collection, I started editing it with Kim Kent, the former managing editor of Willow Springs Books, who is also a poet, and we ended up thinking about the collection like a poet would, and thinking about what's the best entry point for the arrangement of stories, what's the best entry point for individual stories to kind of teach the reader how to read it. And I guess fiction writers do that too, but I just kind of wanted to hear from you, like, how do you define a story?
Yeah, I guess, again, I'm more interested in questions. So less so than saying this is what a story is, I want my writing to ask, what can a story be? What can it do? And so a lot of the pieces in the collection I actually think of more as fictions than as stories. They are prose, and they, you know, they have some of the conventions of a story, like characters, and there's some element of plot or setting. But they, again, are oftentimes not narrative. And I'm less interested in, you know, telling a story where something happens and it happens because of this explanation from the past, and then the way that it's resolved is this. So I'm less interested in a narrative structure like that, and more interested in the language and the questions that I can ask through some of those conventions of fiction.
Well, let's hear another piece of fiction. We won't call it a story, but a short fiction from Jacqueline Watterson's Ventriloquisms.
Sure. I think that a piece that, you know, is a nice example of what I was just talking about that is kind of anti-narrative is actually the last piece in the collection, and it's Yes, Chemistry. A stiff pink rug, your body, heavier and heavier. Arms and legs, eyelids and jaw weighted so that you cannot open your mouth. You, heavy, heavy, quiet. Very, very quiet. You cannot hear your breathing, and organs and muscles heavy so you cannot tell your heartbeat. You, so heavy, your lungs cannot take air. Heavy and quiet. You are lying on a stiff pink rug and you cannot move. You cannot move, and massaging you, me. I am massaging you and you are very, very heavy. Heavier than sinew and bone, densely packed, heavy. Wet ash. You used to enjoy preparing small things, straightening. Now, wet ash in my hands, you, heavy, quiet. What can we say about the past? Atoms and molecules, red-eyed and lean, it pressed upon us. The past was an animal, and it forgave with animal instinct, often. You are lying on the pink rug, pink with your meat, and you are very, very heavy and quiet, quieter than you've ever been, and you are filled with wet ash, and the past was an animal, and I am stitching you up. Here, now. Your father was an animal and gaunt. They say the ashes. Your father was gaunt, an animal, a critter from the crawling parts of the earth. The ash that fills you up. You burst with the heaviness of the ash and your father and chemistry. Yes, chemistry, which you know so little about. Heavier. Quieter, older. You are growing older. Regret the animal. I, like the past, forgive. And if you remember, memory serves. The past is an egg. You filled with ash. Nestled in the ash, an egg. Deep, deep animal egg in you. Regret the animal. Nest the egg. A trembling becomes rumbling. Darkness changes, shifts to the egg in you. Big toe, the egg, the past, the wet ash. You were forgetting that big toe, but it has not forsaken anything. Remembering, remembering, the big toe inside you, the big toe hatched from your egg. We had been girls together, rooting around. The pink rug matted beneath your immense weight and the floor. The floor buckles. You're so heavy, you're going to fall through the floor. Falling through the floor, your seams are going to split. My stitches cannot hold. Atoms and molecules. Now, you have reached a place of annihilation. Your heaviness, older and older, collapses into the discretion of the big toe, and the discretion your father, animals both, critters from the crawling parts of the earth, turn to ash in you. And you break, and you break. You reached the place of annihilation, and you reach deeper. All your body meant was to survive. But you didn't. Heavier, quieter, older, farther and farther. An abyss is only an abyss if you allow yourself to be small. And the luxury of smallness, you never were. That afternoon, the fog cleared to reveal fog. You could not wake up. You were too heavy, heavy and quiet. You said so little, and sometimes you seemed to writhe, but the ash kept you. Silent, you were locked. Locked, you were relevant, vital, dying. Every divergence, new always dawns from the present, within you, here. We will keep this alive. Now lightly yelling, now memorizing that rug pink, tender like flesh or meat, using it in a sentence. You don't have to be sorry anymore. All. From the brink, no longer heavy, no longer quiet. The past passed, and from the egg hatched. What can you say about the present? Begin by saying, places you will never miss, events you can't bring yourself to, compounds and molecules densely packed. We just didn't know how to stop. But you know, it turns colder, and a heaviness like you is not for the weak of heart. Big toe rooting around, big toe wants a yoke. What's different is that now you mean it. On days when no one is known to you, it's as if no one dies. After a break like this, explanations no longer suffice. Only animal instinct. Begin again by saying, now, without all that you cannot say. You were wounded, yes, but first you were small. And you must admit desire for the abysmal. Yes. Open your eyes. Admit.
Thank you. That's Jacqueline Watterson reading from her collection, Ventriloquisms, winner of the Spokane Prize for Short Fiction. And yeah, you were talking just before that about non-narrative structures, and that piece of writing, I don't know if I can call it a story, is, it seemed, especially listening to you read it, was like almost hypnotic. And the second person address, I think, brings the reader in and creates some kind of experience for the reader, which is totally separate from what we would think of as like a story experience where you're learning about characters and their psychology.
Right. Yeah. That. Thank you for saying that, because that was my goal with this piece, to sort of create an experience. And I think it is almost a performative piece that's meant to be read out loud, that achieves whatever it achieves much more effectively when it is read out loud. And speaking of the sort of genesis for different pieces of writing in the collection, this one was inspired by a game that I used to play with friends as a kid that's called Sandman. Hmm. And when you play that game, you lie down on the floor and your friend uses a finger to sort of pretend to be, cutting open your body and, rubbing your muscles so that you feel like you're being filled with sand and becoming heavier. Hmm. And so, I wanted to recreate in prose form and in writing the experience of playing that game and feeling this incredible intimacy and fear with my friends, as a girl. So that's where that came from.
Yeah, very cool. The book Ventriloquisms by Jacqueline Watterson, it truly is a unique piece of fiction. And we're so pleased to have you here today to talk about it and share some of the work with us. It is the winner of the Spokane Prize for Short Fiction, published by Willow Springs Books, which is affiliated with Eastern Washington University's MFA program. Lauren, Interim Assistant Director for Willow Springs Books, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jacqueline Watterson, thanks for being here to share your work.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Messini. Executive producer for The Bookshelf is Vern Windham.